I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Most families have disagreements over something, but sometimes a conflict can tear a family apart, cutting off contact with a parent, a child, a sibling, a close relative. It can be about political differences or disputes about money or parenting issues or playing favorites or, most importantly, about abuse. Carl Pillemer says that family estrangement is more common than we thought. He surveyed more than 1,300 Americans, and 27% said they have been estranged from a member of their family. His new book, Fault Lines, is about what happens and why this happens and the emotional prices paid on both sides of the rift. He also says that reconciliation is possible and requires a game plan, some honest soul searching, and downplaying the expectation of an apology. Carl Pillemer is a professor of human development at Cornell University and joins us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on the show.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, I wanted to begin with a kind of a broad-based question, and I'm thinking about how much pressure families are under these days, living with the stresses, frankly, the uncertainties of the pandemic, concerned about health and jobs and schooling for their children. Do you anticipate that some families will literally just break apart or fracture under the weight of these stresses?
It's a big worry for folks like me who study the family. I think that we've already seen some loosening of family bonds and a greater sense of the voluntary nature of family relationships, and families are under extraordinary stress. I will say, though, it's always a double-edged sword, and some of the work shows that families are pulling together, using social media to restore these bonds, and are really working together to try to get through the crisis. But I would have to agree with you that I think that we're in a situation where the ongoing stresses for families may be reaching the breaking point for some of them.
And your book is really about families where a family member says, I have had it. I am done. I am done with you. I am done with this conflict. You were surprised, and frankly, I was surprised that about a quarter of the people that you talked to said it has happened to them and their families. Were you surprised about that?
Absolutely. You know, often numbers from surveys don't speak for themselves. And in this case, they really spoke very loudly. I didn't anticipate that over a quarter of a random sample of Americans, so translating to over 65 million people, would answer yes to the question, are you estranged from a relative? That is, you have no contact with him or her anymore. And so the fact that in our hyper-connected society, where it's hard to get away from anybody, as many as 65 million American adults have this kind of a situation in their family. And let me add, These weren't people in the survey who had simply drifted apart. Many of them, or most, said it was at least to some degree upsetting. And so they were aware of the estrangement and bothered by it to some degree. I'll tell you one other interesting thing. That rate of estrangement didn't differ by race, gender, educational level. So it seems like it's both a widespread problem and what you might call an equal opportunity problem.
And it seemed that sort of equally distributed among rifts with parents, rifts from or with siblings, or rifts with and from close relatives. So they were either 10%, 8%, or 9%. So pretty much pretty even Steven there.
Exactly. And this was the first study, and it's one of the things I really wanted to do when I started to research this issue. Almost all the very limited literature on estrangement right now is between parents and children. And I suspect that being estranged from a sibling or from a beloved uncle or a cousin who one grew up with would also be very distressing. So we looked across all close family relationships. Yes, and we found that actually estrangement from siblings is both quite common and quite troubling. So it's not just parents and children who are involved in this. People can feel the severe ripple effects of estrangement from a variety of relatives.
Well, and what I really appreciate in the book are it's full of small anecdotes of people talking about how a fractured family has affected them and hurt them. One from a woman named Felice Hoskins talked about this open wound. Now, I don't know what the details of this family rift was about, but she says you can't fix it. You can't change it. It's still there every day. You can't recover from it. I will tell you, I went through divorce. I went through heart surgery. A piece of cake compared with losing a child like this. There is so much pain in this book.
You know, I had no idea before I began this study, first of all, how shameful people experienced the problem as and how isolated they felt. So, you know, we have a society now where people seem to live their lives in public and reveal almost anything. This was for almost everyone in the study something they rarely, if ever, spoke with anyone else about. They often described it as shameful, as feeling alone, as feeling as if their family were the weirdest in the world. So that was one core piece of this, that people feel stigmatized. When they tell someone about it, they can imagine a cartoon bubble appearing over their head saying, "What's wrong with you? What did you do to make it happen?" Also, I found, I think one of the discoveries I made in this series of studies that I describe in Fault Lines is how this is a source of chronic stress. It pushes buttons in our fundamental human social nature that make it extraordinarily painful and more painful than some other stressful events. So it is an ongoing chronic source of stress. And the way that the person you read, you know, described it, this notion that it's an open wound that doesn't heal. That's true for a surprising number of people. It affects their physical and mental well-being over time.
And if you think of a family as a system, it really does reverberate throughout the system. People take sides. And I know this from, you know, anecdotes from people that I know about their particular families.
It's extraordinarily difficult to be someone who is, as I called it in the book, collateral damage for an estrangement. One really interesting thing was we reached out to college students and interviewed a number of college students who were experiencing estrangements in their families. Often they go home just spending their time talking with their parent about what their uncle or aunt did. So it's a secondary kind of emotional stress. And for people caught in the middle, it's especially difficult for someone who has relationships with all of the other folks. So one point in the book, we really do argue in this book and in other things we've written, people need to consider when they begin an estrangement what these ripple effects are going to be. Because you may end up cleaving the family in two for all generations to come. It sounds extreme, but this is what happened in some of the families. So people need to think of what kind of legacy they're passing on in this collateral damage.
In fact, you include someone who describes families fracturing generations ago, and it continues from one generation to the next. The idea of cutting someone off or shunning them or disappearing from the family.
Yeah, I love to talk to folks in Philadelphia because my ancestors are from that area.
Oh,
and I describe in the book a situation where in my grandparental generation, there was a rift between the siblings. So I myself have a whole side of the family who could have been helpful supporters, passers on a family tradition, who we know almost nothing about. And I think that people don't realize this legacy of estrangement. A number of people who were estranged, when I asked them why, described it as a family theme. Oh, my grandparents were, you know, estranged, and my mother was estranged from her father. So this does create a damaging family history that it's really worth thinking about whether you want that to take place in your own family.
Well, and I mentioned in my introduction, you know, conflicts about money, political differences, things like that. What are the most, I guess, salient reasons for a rift in the family or a fractured family? Is it some kind of volcanic event that just says, that's it, I'm done? Or is this a slow burn or a combination of the above?
Great question. And the answer is sort of all of the above. One thing which did characterize most of the estrangements was what I call in the book a volcanic event. So this flashbulb moment, a moment in time when someone did something and it changed everything. And I point out in the book that we know from psychology that relationships don't always progress in a straight line. There are these transformational events that can somehow turn a relationship around completely. So we did find that one way to get over an estrangement is to process the event. A few other main causes is one I call the long arm of the past. So the groundwork for an estrangement is established early in a person's life through disruptions or difficulties, harsh parenting, emotional or physical abuse. Another more proximal cause that's quite frequent is what I call the problematic in-law, where in-law relations or partner relationships cause strange. And money and inheritance, money may not be the root of all evil, but it's the origin of a striking number of estrangements. Other reasons we could come back to are value and lifestyle differences and unmet expectations for what a family member ought to do.
And speaking of this volcanic moment, I mean, is it just the fight that kind of ends all fight, where you just one party or perhaps even both parties say, that's it, I am not going to deal with you anymore in my life?
In analyzing these volcanic events, it's sometimes a relatively trivial event. So often people who are estranged, when they tell the story, find the person who's listening to them scratching their head and wondering, really, was that all that happened? The person came late for the wedding, or your brother didn't show up that one time to help your mother. That's really what caused it. I learned in the book that these events encapsulate years often of difficulties that through poor communication were never expressed. But one of my respondents who gave me the term said, it's like in a volcano doesn't always erupt from the top. It gets blocked and the lava pours out of the side. That was the concept, that this buildup of poor communication and anger extends itself in an event. And it can sometimes be something surprisingly trivial, as I'm sure you may have encountered too in talking to people.
Well, absolutely. And it does feel, I mean, and we're almost up in a break here, but it sounds like just sort of years of building up resentment then sort of blows up into this conflict that severs the family.
Right. And a cascade of poor communication leading eventually to a kind of stonewalling. If it's not intervened in, that's what can lead to the end of the relationship.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Carl Pillemer about his new book. It's called Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them. He's a professor of human development at Cornell University. And you can join us. There's several ways you can do it. We want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and join the conversation much more after this very short break. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Now, most families have disagreements over something, but sometimes a conflict can tear a family apart, and that's what we're talking about with family sociologist Carl Pillemer. And again, he's got a new book, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them. You know, Carl, I was thinking in preparation for the show, this was many, many years ago, I had a very close friend, not a member of the family, but a very close friend, and just one day, everything turned, and she shunned me and turned her back on me and never sort of, we never processed it, we never resolved it, I never understood it. And I remember how painful that was. So I'm thinking, if that were a member of my family, how much even more painful that would be.
You know, it's very true. And one thing I point out in the book is there is really powerful research from social psychology on the phenomenon of rejection. So it's one thing if you just lose someone, but if someone consciously rejects you in the way that you've just described, it calls forth in us a lot of ways that we try to protect ourselves. It's a threat to our self-esteem and to our self-image. So it cuts very, very deeply, this concept that someone who has been close to you, perhaps who you feel that you've nurtured or cared about, does this total break. So it's that aspect of rejection that often pushes people into the psychological distress and into becoming highly defensive, so defensive that it's hard to even see a way out of it. And you've described that there are situations where it's extraordinarily difficult to get the other person to communicate. Yeah. So say when you try to communicate with them, they say, well, you should know this, or I shouldn't have to explain it to you. So it can create a very damaging event for people's self-esteem when something like that happens. Also, the way you've described it, it creates ambiguity. Someone is psychologically present, but not physically present. So you're stuck in this ambiguous moment. And we humans like certainty. We don't like ongoing ambiguity. And that's what happens in a situation like you've described.
Well, here's Christine, who you quote in the book, who says, as you were just describing, she says, when rejection happens from your family, it's ultimate. When rejection happens, you tend to lose everything. You lose your self-esteem, your confidence. You question who you are. You doubt everything. And you were the lowest of the low. I wanted to try to move forward with my life, but I couldn't because I had this, because this had such a hold on me. Just to underscore what you were saying there. Let me pick up on you write about, and you mentioned, when there is abuse, whether emotional abuse or physical abuse in the family, how do you see children then of abusive parents either trying to resolve this issue or trying to move on with their lives by just turning their back on the parent and say, okay, I'm done with you. I'm not going to have anything to do with you. You're not going to hurt me anymore.
You know, I'm glad you asked that question because one way in which the book has been maybe slightly controversial is I've heard from a number of people who said, you've talked to people who reconciled and you offer guidelines for how to reconcile, but what if my family experience was just so awful, you know, that I was a victim of sexual abuse or physical abuse? And I'm always clear about that. There are situations where people are in a dangerous situation, either emotionally or physically, or where their childhood experience was so averse with a parent or a sibling that it probably is better for them to learn to cope with the estrangement rather than reconciling. And I'm really quite clear about that, and I think you raised the point. I did, however, in my research, find people, quite a few of them, who had had those experiences and decided to reconcile in spite of them. So I'm not preaching that to people, but I am indicating that there are individuals who have found helpful and fulfilling reconciliation even after what some might call a sort of toxic childhood. So people need to walk their own balance. I also strongly recommend for people who've been in a situation that's been quite difficult or abusive, who are thinking of reconciling, it's always valuable to talk it out with a trained mental health professional first to really make sure it's the right thing to do, that you aren't placing yourself in emotional danger. It's worth really talking to someone and thinking it out before you attempt a reconciliation with that kind of difficult family situation.
Absolutely. And I would think you really have to want this for some reason, correct?
It is true. I mean, in terms of people who reconciled, I learned something that really surprised me. So in the studies, I did the largest study of people who had reconciled with a family member after a long estrangement. So I interviewed in depth over 100 people who had reconciled. Now, these might not have been perfect reconciliations, but everyone who did it felt positively about it, but they had to clearly determine if they were ready. And the number one reason people gave was it was not for the other person. People did it for themselves. They experienced a feeling of a weight off their shoulders. I mean, my best quote is the man who said, I was estranged from my brother for 25 years and we finally talked. This is the first day that it's not on my mind that I haven't talked to my brother for 25 years. So a major motivation for doing this, people felt it was a weight on their shoulders which they were able to release, even if the reconciliation were imperfect.
Let me just follow up, and then we got a lot of people that want to join us here, but you also say don't expect an apology. I mean, it's always nice to get an apology because it means someone, I think, has sort of recognized what they have done to somebody. But you're saying don't prioritize that.
Well, imagine the history of an estrangement. One brother feels that his sibling was a sadist, and the sibling believes that he was just doing ordinary teasing. After 30 years, reconciling that entire past is extremely unlikely to happen. When people ask for an apology, they often don't want an apology for a single thing. They want an apology for their entire childhood or for who the other person is. And almost everyone who reconciled abandoned the idea that the person had to apologize as a prerequisite, and often an apology occurred later. So I did, that was a surprising finding, that people who reconciled abandoned the apology, feeling it wasn't necessary, and let the two paths live as separate paths and didn't attempt to reconcile them.
Because you're saying that we don't agree on our past, even our shared pasts.
Exactly. And we not only don't agree on them, we develop a narrative that we become extremely wedded to, and that's what narrative psychology shows us. And we reinforce our view of that past by talking with friends or other relatives who agree with us so that it becomes ossified. I had people who said, yeah, I realized I wasn't about to apologize any more than my parents were. So it's really a sense for folks who reconcile, even if they weren't happy with it, they found that abandoning the idea that I can impose my idea of what went on 25 years ago on the other person, they all realized that wasn't going to work. It was painful for some of them, but it pretty much was a prerequisite to reconciling.
And that is Carl Pillemer, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Fault Lines, Fractured Families and How to Mend Them. And he is a family sociologist at Cornell University, a professor of human development at Cornell. And we've got a lot of people that want to join us. Let me just make sure our listeners can weigh in and jump in on our conversation. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. That's email. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. In fact, let me get Michael from Harleysville to join our conversation. And Michael, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me. You guys have been like a rock during this whole thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in. I've been listening to the segments about estrangement, and I actually had my own kind of falling out with my brother and his wife, who are co-workers of mine, and kind of split part of the family up as well. And just wanted to chime in about that. And I like that you mentioned or discussed today about people kind of caught in the middle, especially children. My nephews and nieces were kind of caught in the middle, so I made sure and probably recommend to your listeners, you know, just to send a private note to them, letting them know that you still care and love them and, you know, what's going on. Hopefully one day will be resolved, and if mm-hmm. not, you would like to still continue the relationship with them at a certain point when they're older, if possible.
And Michael, are you part of a family business? Is that where the rift happened?
Yeah, I worked for my brother. It was actually his company for about 10 years. Just shy of 10 years. We had a falling out right after the kind of restrictions of quarantine were lifted. We could actually get back to business, and we ended up parting ways. And that caused a rift for my parents with him, and it's been a big ordeal. We have not talked in at least 6 months, 4 or 5 months.
Oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. Let me see what Carl Pillemer has to say. And I wonder, Carl, with family business, whether that has some potential for some of these rifts we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And let me first say that I really love the advice, if you're estranged from someone, to try to limit the collateral damage. So in some cases, people do encourage, for example, the cousins to remain friends, even if the parental generation is having a rift. Trying to avoid pulling your children into this rift and keeping them, for example, from seeing other nieces and nephews. I'm really glad that that's, you know, happened in this family, and I hope they'll continue it. I'm doing some work with family business groups right now because this is surprisingly common. It is really, really difficult because businesses, maybe like you're describing, are sort of a zero-sum game. There are sometimes where a simple compromise isn't possible, and people mix the emotions of families with the problems of the business. I will say there are good places around, small business consultants, et cetera, who do specifically work with families to help them move through this. And I don't know if this might work for the listener, but because what happened in your family is certainly not the first time and certainly not the last, there are people who have experience in helping family businesses through this, and it might be worth checking into.
Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I hope you and your family can come to some kind of resolution. Let me see what Ruth Ann from Delaware has to say. And Ruth Ann, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you. This is an amazing conversation.
Oh, thank you.
For this moment in history. I was estranged from my mother for quite a long time, and I was in a lot of pain. And I chose, for my own health and recovery, to go out of my way to restore some level of relationship. And I am really happy about that. But my adult daughter is estranged from me now. And we have had a very hard time trying to find any place to even see each other. And that's so devastating to me. But here's my question.
Sure.
I felt that I healed because I recognized that there were some areas of my life I was soft. I needed to get tougher. I needed to build up some tough skin and just handle some things so that I can carry on in a grown-up way. But when I want that for my daughter, it backfires. And I don't know when a person needs to build up their muscles and be more disciplined and strong and tough it out, and when a person needs to be catered to and cared for more gently or just left alone.
Sure.
I don't know the difference.
Well, Ruth Ann, I'm not sure we can answer that directly, but I think the fact that you have this rift with your daughter is something that Carl would probably want to respond to. Carl, any thoughts?
Sure. And Ruth Ann, about how old is your daughter?
She is
30.
Right. We have an interesting situation here, and there's a fact about parent-child relations that you may have experienced yourself. And it's not that children are bad people, but we know from decades of sociological research, we parents care more about the relationship. So study after study has shown that we have more to lose. That, and in my studies too, adult children are much more likely to say, at least for a while, this relationship is stressful, I'm going to get out of it for now. So one decision people have to make, and I think it's, you put it beautifully, what do I want to sacrifice to continue in this relationship? Because I'm in my mid-60s, many of us have thought, well, these family relationships are sacred and we can kind of behave however we would like and people will stick with us. Our adult children don't really feel that way. They feel it to some extent, but also it's easier for them to exit. So one thing I argue in the book is that we have to decide what's the least we can accept and sometimes really find what the child wants and go with it because it simply is easier for them to exit. I hate to put it that way, but it might be wise, to really ask her, what are the limits you're trying to set? What are your terms? What are the boundaries you're trying to keep? And then make a conscious decision as to whether you can do that or not. That's what many people found work. It worked is understand the child's terms and, decide which ones of them you can adhere to. I don't know if that actually applies to you, but that was the experience of many parents who eventually did reconcile after problems with their adult children.
And Maria, I really appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate your call,
That's
and I wish you, I'm glad you feel that way. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Carl, just picking up on that, in terms of reconciliation, you don't want the old relationship. I assume you want something new. That's sometimes hard to create, especially within families where things feel, so set in stone. How do you set up new kind of rules and regulations and boundaries and guidelines and say, this is acceptable, this is not?
One thing about there's so many good points about that. One of the positive things, if I can call it that, it's not really positive, but I think you'll get my sense, is an estrangement sometimes shakes everyone up. When someone realizes that this could actually happen, they become more amenable to talking about the relationship and thinking about it. So one thing people tend to do in order to make this work is to reduce their expectations, that people come to the conclusion that their sibling or parent isn't going to become the ideal person they wanted. So people who reconciled accepted that they couldn't change the relative. And what they did was often come to a point of asking, what's the least I can accept in this relationship? And this goes beyond a vague sense of boundaries. People need to tell each other exactly what has to happen for the reconciliation to occur and stick with it. And one fascinating thing I found is many people who reconciled framed things as one last chance under very clear terms. I can try this again if X happens or if Y happens. I will add one thing, too. There was a sense of personal growth, of positiveness, because when you're out of the relationship, you can't process it all. It's like that scene in Sleeping Beauty where everybody freezes in mid-step and nothing else happens. So when you're estranged, you lose the possibility to see how people may have changed, grown, or developed. And that's one reason to at least establish a minimal contact, because it lets you process the relationship. Again, if it's a dangerous or abusive relationship, that's an exception. But for many people, having some contact allows you to grow as a person in a way that you can't if the estrangement's going on.
And that is Carl Pillemer. We're talking about his new book. It's called Fault Lines, Fractured Families, and How to Mend Them. He's a professor of human development at Cornell University. And we've got a lot of people who want to join our conversation. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us, as our other callers have, 1-888-477-9499. And we'll talk about political rifts after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Carl Pillemer is our guest. He's a professor of human development at Cornell University, author of a new book we are talking about. It's called Fault Lines, Fractured Families, and How to Mend Them. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation, but I want to toss in when there are political disagreements that have fractured families, and as we all know, Carl Pillemer, this was a very partisan, very charged political year. And while Joe Biden got 7 million more votes than Donald Trump, there's still some 70 million people that voted for each of these candidates, and it has fractured a lot of families and relationships. Is there a way to heal this?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, since I've been doing this work on estrangement, it's no surprise that people frequently ask me, how can I repair my family after the election? And you're right. An epidemic of family feuds has broken out that's pitted Trump and Biden supporters against one another in this really intimate sphere of the family. And at worst, people are cutting themselves off completely from relatives. Yeah. And some relationships might not recover. I would propose three strategies to families based on the work I've done. Number one is something that is a simple solution but not easy, and that's stop talking about it. Create a demilitarized zone in the family, because your listeners can ask themselves this question, and it really helps. Is there any possibility I will change my relative's mind? And if the answer is no, you can let it go. I think a problem in families, Marty, is that many of us who are Democrats or who are Republicans don't know anybody on the other side. So a Democrat going home to their family, for example, may encounter the only Trump supporters they can yell at. And so having a demilitarized zone is a great idea. Also in families, to set clear limits and stick with them. You know, a statement along the lines, I love you, but I refuse to discuss the election with you. I'm not going to respond to it. Helps people feel more in control. And finally, the third thing I would offer is, if you're going to talk politics, use basic communication skills like, you know, describing how you feel rather than condemning the other person. Let it become a more positive discussion. But one thing I would strongly recommend is, again, this idea of a political demilitarized zone. If you're home right now, agree not to go into it, because very rarely are these family discussions organized around a positive, interesting exchange of ideas. They really are the one opportunity to show the other side how wrong they are, and it's not going to work in most families.
I like the idea of a DMZ. Let me get some more callers back in on the caller in the conversation. Here's Maria from Philadelphia. And Maria, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi
there.
Hi. So I have a question for you. My husband and I have four stepchildren. Well, I have four stepchildren. He has four biological kids. And they're estranged from their mom. They range in age from 7 to 13. They have not spoken to her in months. She refuses to call them. She won't speak to them. And he still allows them to see their grandparents, but they make excuses. Oh, she doesn't call because she thinks she can, or she doesn't want to talk to your dad. And we're at a point where we want to encourage a healthy relationship, but when she has spoken to them before, she's been extremely abusive, awful, and we just don't know what to do. We don't want them to have a chip on their shoulder and have low self-esteem. We know that they feel rejected. You know, they ask questions. Why doesn't mom call? And we try to be as open and honest as possible without smearing her. But we're at a loss for what to do.
Oh, Maria, that's such a powerful call and obviously so painful as well. Carl, what do you think?
You know, I wish I had a better answer for that one, and I completely sympathize. One of the main reasons for estrangement I found in the studies is this legacy of divorce, where, you know, the loss of contact with one parent, hostility maybe, can weaken these parent-child bonds. I think that counseling can help, or getting some professional advice for how to deal with it. Unfortunately, it may take the children getting old enough that they can have an independent relationship with the parent, with the absent parent, and learn how to do it themselves. I think you're right. The trying to mediate in a situation like that is extraordinarily difficult, especially if the parent is perceived as being damaging to the kids. So I think certainly openly discussing it, but also it might be a situation where the older the children get and the more they can understand and can make their own decisions about the relationship. I think you're absolutely right not to prevent contact if the children are interested. But you've got a situation that obviously there is no easy answer to, and those would be the best advice that I and the family therapists I've talked to would probably come up with.
Marie, is that helpful? Is that helpful to you?
Somewhat. A court actually decided that she was relatively toxic and that she had to take some steps to get her, you know, her emotional and mental health together before heavy interaction. But she's always been able to call and talk, and she just refuses. And because her family enables and tells them and makes excuses instead of saying, well, look, you know, she has things to do before she can take steps, and she's not doing them, it just puts my husband in a really difficult spot.
And it's got to be very difficult for the kids who, you know, I don't know how old they are, but certainly interpret this as a rejection, you know, on a personal level. And that needs to be obviously, you know, like they need to be insulated against that. It sounds like that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah. I mean, Maria, it sounds like when Carl says maybe seeking a therapist or a counselor or someone who you can talk to in a more intimate way. But I really appreciate the call, and I wish you best of luck as well. It's a tough situation. Thanks for calling in. We got a lot of callers here, which is terrific. We've got Nathaniel, and he's calling us from Chester County. Nathaniel, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling in. I'm currently in a rift situation with two siblings. It's not heated, but due to the circumstances of the pandemic, we're kind of limited due to location and the circumstances of the virus to, like, contrived communication, which has been just mainly text and social media. And I'm actually due to see both of them in person separately on Christmas Eve. And I'm preparing, actually, to sort of present my side as compassionately as I can for them. And we have different perspectives and backgrounds kind of leading up to that on an abusive parent, and we've handled it in two different ways.
I hear you. Carl, what do you think?
You know, I'd love to ask you a question about that,
sure.
Which it sounds like you have really prepared and thought about it. A question to ask yourself is Christmas Eve the best moment? Would it be better to, I mean, the reason I ask is one of the advice that people give, and feel free to take it or leave it, but in talking to people who are reconciled, they often recommend not processing the whole issue in sort of a holiday, Thanksgiving, a wedding kind of thing. They often would suggest to sort of allow a kind of more passive or gentle rebonding to occur, because those situations have such an emotional charge to them already. And so one thing maybe to ask yourself, and it might be the opportune moment, it might be the right time to do it, but it might also be the moment to experience Christmas Eve together. You know, the other thing they would argue is just make sure, if you can in advance, as to whether that's the receptive moment for them. Are they ready to talk about it at that point, and to sort of allow them to make the decision? A third piece of advice they give, which sounds like you're doing, is envision the scenarios. Talk them out in your head. If this opportunity to talk about it is rejected in this moment, you know, do I leave? Do I accept it? To really play out the specific scenarios that might occur, and even talk them out with someone else in the family or somebody else, to really have a plan. Leaving things up to chance in sort of an emotionally charged holiday moment can be challenging. Also, you raise a great point. So much of the communication about something as complex as estrangement now takes place through Facebook posts and texts. It's very, very difficult to get a sense of what's really going on. So I'll be curious to hear what happens,
sure.
But I might, you know, ponder the exact moment and timing of the deep conversation and whether everybody's really ready for it at that moment.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and good luck with that as well. I wonder, too, Carl, whether does it make any sense to send a letter or even an email, I mean, a private email, saying these are some of the things I've been thinking about. I would like to find some time and place where we can discuss it, to sort of pave the way rather than making a pronouncement at some kind of a get-together.
There was great advice on that from people who reconciled. When people, yes, they suggest, especially if someone else has initiated the estrangement and you're on the outside trying to get back in, a heartfelt letter can really help. Unfortunately, because of the anger and the pain of the resentment, people sometimes write in those letters something like, I don't know what you want me to apologize for, I'll apologize for anything. Or, you know, they bring up the past hurt. A genuine letter describing that you understand what's going on and steps that you might be willing to do to make a change. It's not guaranteed to work at all, but that kind of a statement can be very helpful. It may be rejected, but in a number of cases, it was a prompt for someone else to reach out. It does require that you sit and ask yourself, though, again, this idea, what's the least I can accept in the relationship? If the relative comes back and says, which has happened in my studies, okay, Mom, I'm willing to see you. I never want to see Dad again, and he can't have a relationship with my grandchildren, with his grandchildren. Are you willing to accept that or not? Right. It may not be that extreme. So ask yourself in advance of the letter what you'll do when the person responds. But yes, sometimes that kind of a heartfelt statement, especially noting how behaviors may change in the future that were problematic for the person who became estranged, can really have a major impact. Not a guarantee by any means.
And just a quick follow-up on that, because then I do want to get back to our listeners, but even if someone in the family is the so-called perpetrator, are we all responsible for our own reactions?
That was so powerful in my interviews. Of the 100 or so people who reconciled, nearly everyone said that they were able to do it in part because they examined their own role in the estrangement. Not, and I make this clear, not that they accepted blame, but in almost every case, there were series, thousands of micro interactions that both people participated in. And it was very empowering for people to look back and think, could I have done something different? Did I have any role in it? Many found, even if they believed the relative was at fault, they had played enough of a part that they could use that as an entree back into the relationship. So stopping and thinking about the relationship from the standpoint of an objective third party, looking at what you might have done that helped to promote the estrangement, of the people who reconciled, almost 100% found that uniquely valuable, that process.
Wow. We're almost out of time here. Let me just read, we have a caller, Vida from Doylestown. We don't have time, unfortunately, to take her call, but she says she wants to reunite her husband and his father. So playing the kind of go-between, the negotiator, any advice for that?
One thing I would argue is if you feel you can do it, do it. A surprising number, or perhaps not surprising number, of reconciliations came through someone else saying, isn't it time to call your brother now? Or can't you bury the hatchet? So I would encourage people to try it if they feel that, for example, the husband is receptive. And also offer the opportunity to talk it out, to work through scenarios. If you call him, what will happen? That kind of a listening ear from somebody who loves you does push people towards reconciliation if they want it. So I'd say go for it, but work through the person, not just urging them to do it, but talking through with them what it would be like to do it is really helpful.
And a comment from Dave, he says, my family's intact, but I feel borderline estrangement. All five of us spend way too much time on our devices. We ignore each other and seem to want to do anything but engage with each other. What does your guest think about this? So it's not there was some big rift. It's just that they're not connected.
Right. And we refer to that as kind of a passive estrangement. Part of that may be hard to address because that just might be the family history and the family culture. And I understand that is really frustrating. I think trying to arrange events, trying to arrange individual conversations with people, it's so true that people get lost in their media. I would just say to that listener, if you've got a couple of other folks in the family who agree with you, taking steps to make these family interactions more meaningful really will have a payoff. How you do it is probably unique to your family, but I would just endorse that idea of trying to get beyond the, you know, the more a shallow communication and into something deeper is a great idea.
Well, Carl Pillemer, you really hit on something because we had so many people that wanted to join our conversation. My apologies to those we did not get on the air. And my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, and if I could add, if folks would like to send in questions or experiences, we have a website at thefamilyreconciliation.org, and that has a whole sort of sounding board where people can write in questions, ideas, their own experiences, and we try to respond to them as best we can.
Oh, that's terrific.
So we'd love to hear from you, and we're always interested.
And we will put that information out on social media so that people can do that. Carl Pillemer, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, it's been delightful. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of human development at Cornell University. And again, his new book is Fault Lines, Fractured Families, and How to Mend Them. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. And you can get a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us. And again, thanks for all those calls and comments.